cold when master the abstract. Step back and feel the contrast. Echoes of a broken past. Before my eyes, the future flashed. Concepts, the moment past. Fear of the manifest. Waging battle on my spirit. Surrender to what's fearless. See what bodies mix of love and lust. When love was hard to touch, I toss a prayer your way. Namaste, baby, namaste.
Namaste, namaste.
Welcome to Yoga Talk, the Yoga International podcast. That was The Householders with our intro, Namaste Nation. I'm your host, Kat Hegberg.
Hi, I'm Emily. I'm the producer at Yoga International, and we have with us today Sandy Anderson.
Yes, welcome, Sandy.
Thank you.
Sandy is my teacher and Emily's teacher as well, and we're really excited to ask her a little yoga Q&A today. But before we get started with that, Sandy, could you tell our listeners a little bit about yourself?
Well, I have been studying and practicing yoga for more than 30 years, so you can see that I might have gray hair, even though you can't see that on this podcast. And I've been living at the Institute for the last 25 years. That's the Himalayan Institute, where I had the pleasure of meeting both Kat and Emily. And at the Institute, I do teachers' trainings and regular kinds of teaching, weekend workshops, and I travel quite a bit as well.
Yeah, so if you have a question about yoga practice, yoga teaching, Sandy is the one to ask, pretty much. And we're going to do just that. We're going to ask her some of your questions that you guys submitted to us via Facebook and Twitter and email. And I have the first question here. Our first question is, what other types of fitness do you do in addition to your yoga practice? And do you encourage your clients or students to do other types of fitness as well?
I personally have found that I do well with a little additional cardiovascular work, whether that's walking up and down the hill outside of our building here at the Himalayan Institute, or the riding a exercise bike, or whatever it might be, depending on your interests and your other skill sets and your fitness levels. I also have found, depending on your practice, the nature of your physical practice, you might benefit from other kinds of activities. So as I have gotten older and my physical practice has gotten more subtle, I've increased the other kinds of physical activity I do to keep muscle tone and strength and so on. So occasionally going to the gym and doing some things like that is working very well for me. So I think it depends a little on the nature of your practice and the other activities in your life, but I would not assume that your yoga practice alone will compensate for all of the things that you might need to do to keep yourself healthy.
Yeah, that's been really apparent to me recently because I got this Fitbit, which I'm showing Sandy and Emily the Fitbit on my wrist for Christmas. And it's like a fitness tracker that coordinates with an app on my phone. And every day I look at the app and it tells me how many active minutes I've had during the day. And I find it like really fascinating that it can usually tell what I'm doing. Like it'll say, oh, you did 30 minutes of aerobics, or you did an hour run, or whatever it is that I did. And when I do yoga, it doesn't register as anything. My yoga registers as the same as me like sitting at my desk at work or sitting in my computer or watching television. And that was really surprising. So I guess my heart rate just like, even though I think of the practice that I do as pretty vigorous, my heart rate just doesn't get up high enough and I'm just not moving enough for that to count for my daily fitness. And that was kind of an eye-opener, like, okay, my yoga gives me so many benefits, but cardiovascular fitness is not one of them and I need to do other things.
Yeah, that is surprising because your practice is probably much more vigorous than what your average person is doing. So, but I'm not surprised. I feel sometimes that the more skillful you are at practicing yoga, the less your heart rate is elevated.
Right, right.
And that's the point of doing it.
Yeah.
So definitely the cardiovascular is important. I'm for myself, I find I just start dropping down energetically. I really need to work up a sweat, and I don't do that with my asana practice because my intention there is much different.
Exactly.
Yeah. One thing that's a little bit different is I found that when I do weight training or when I do some type of exercise other than yoga, my yoga practice becomes more effortless. And so yes. I'm not doing my yoga practice to get in my exercise anymore. Mm-hmm. I'm doing my yoga practice to do my practice, and then I'm doing my exercise to get in my exercise. So it's kind of nice for me to keep the two, like, separate.
Yeah.
Yeah, absolutely.
I think part of it also is the modern, for most of us, a lot of our day. I mean, for me, I'm afraid if I wore that fitness tracker, it would never get off zero. And so, and I suspect my lifestyle is probably similar to many people who have very sedentary lives without even realizing how little we actually use our physical strength.
Oh, yeah. I mean, like, working in an office, it's shocking just to see, like, even the difference between, like, a Saturday and a work day. Like, on a work day, you're supposed to get in, I guess, 10,000 steps a day. And on a work day, I really struggle. Like, I have to walk around the block a few times. But on a weekend, it's just, you know, natural because we're up and we're moving. And, yeah, I think, if anything, that's one thing that I discovered from the fitness tracker experiment is that I'm far more sedentary than I thought. Yeah. So yeah, I think that we would all agree that doing a little bit of extra cardiovascular work, perhaps some weight training in addition to our yoga practice is overall a pretty solid thing.
All right. I'm going to ask the second question from our listeners, which is, will you please speak about ahimsa or compassion for oneself when returning to yoga? I started doing yoga at 8 years old. As an adult, I was doing Ashtanga, and then I experienced chronic unwellness. Now that I've rehabilitated, I have difficulty even with restorative yoga. The mind becomes frustrated and then avoids continuing the practice. Your insights are greatly appreciated. Anything, Sandy?
I'm wondering if, do you understand this to mean that restorative yoga is the only yoga that's appropriate in the circumstances?
That's what I took the question to mean, that maybe that before that this person had quite a vigorous practice, and that now that even restorative can be a challenge.
Mm-hmm. And boring, it
and
sounds
it seems,
like.
Yeah. Mentally frustrating.
Yeah. Yeah. You know, I just feel if you're not getting something out of your practice, then maybe it's not the right practice. Mm. So if you're really bored and frustrated, then it might be that that's just not the right thing to be doing right now. And I don't know if there's some other benefit or some reason why you need to be practicing restorative yoga. I can understand why maybe the vigorous vinyasa kind of work is not appropriate, but there might be some middle ground that would still be engaging and interesting, but not as vigorous as a former practice. You know, our expectations are very poisonous for us often, especially when it's the past. You know, I used to be able to do da-da-da-da, and now I'm not, and you're very unhappy with yourselves because in the past is not the same. But we have to, part of what yoga is about, of course, is letting go of that kind of judgment on ourselves, that kind of expectation, and making peace with reality in the moment, and accepting that our practice at this moment is something other than what it was yesterday. And that's true for all of us, even if it's somewhat similar. So I think practicing some kind of compassion and a non-judgmental attitude towards ourselves is something that all yoga students need to do, especially if you've been kind of driven or ambitious in your practice, and to reframe what it is you're expecting to achieve from practice, and have that be more of some kind of an inner sense of well-being as being the ultimate goal, rather than the accomplishment of X number of sun salutations or mastery of a particular posture that requires either strength or flexibility or whatever. And when your goal switches to an inner state of being, then you are more likely to do the things that help you achieve that and be content with that, even if it's something as simple as a restorative pose or sort of a range of movement through the joints. So it may be that cultivating that kind of an intention for your practice would help. And it could be that you need to do a different kind of practice as well.
Sandy, do you ever recommend to your students or to people that they try a different mind-based or mind-body like system, like Qigong or anything like that?
Well,
what is your opinion on it?
I think it's probably really valuable, but I don't have a whole lot of experience with some of the other modalities. Are you thinking in this particular case that something like Tai Chi or some kind of a gentle movement thing might work better? Yeah, mm-hmm. That might be a really good suggestion, something to try. You know, part of it is that I find those things boring, so I don't have any training. So, but you have a really broad background, Emily. So that might be a good suggestion.
A narrower background than you might think. But yeah, I thought that I would find Tai Chi really boring because it's so slow. But then once I got to a class, the instructor was so very precise with each movement that like I couldn't stop. I mean, I thought about myself an awful lot in the practice, but it was all like body awareness. Uh-huh. And I compared it to the way that I practice yoga, and the way that I practice yoga has become so like fluid, and I don't really think about it anymore, that having to like constantly readjust and like feel where I am in space was a really good exercise, even just for my brain.
Cross training.
Yeah,
that's probably really valuable for those of us who've been practicing so long. You know, things get on rote. Which is good on the one hand, but can also allow the mind not to be present. Mm-hmm. So when you go some new activity, you really have to pay attention, and that's a good lesson.
Yeah. So I have another question for you, Sandy. The question is, I found it very challenging to maintain a daily pranayama practice, but don't have much trouble practicing asana and meditation regularly. I've heard similar complaints from other folks. Why is maintaining a daily pranayama practice so much more challenging than other disciplines like asana and meditation? What is it about pranayama that is different?
You know, I think there are two things about pranayama. One, it's much more subtle, so you don't necessarily notice the effect right away. And therefore, you tend to just sort of drop it, and it becomes that thing that I should be doing, but I'm not.
Yeah.
And I think a lot of people practice pranayama before they really have the preparation in place, and the preparation being a fairly serious and sophisticated asana practice. And by that, I don't mean necessarily mastery over the most difficult postures or a huge amount of flexibility, but kind of an inner integration and an inner focus and a very inner sense of stability and a sensitivity, really, to the pranic body itself. And then the effects become more apparent to you, or your technique is more refined, and you begin to enjoy the practice and to choose that in place of other things because you really realize how much it stabilizes and energizes you. The other thing that I think is interesting about pranayama, and one of the reasons why I notice myself stopping pranayama practice, is because it works on a much more subtle level, there's a subtle resistance to change. You know, we jump for the thing that we pull back towards the things that are familiar. Mm-hmm. So the minute you start feeling at a very profound level, at the very profound pranic level, start feeling different, it's slightly uncomfortable. And so you unconsciously pull back, even though it might be better. You know, you might be feeling better and more energetic, but it's a new state that's unfamiliar, and it takes, you know, you reach for the comfort zone. And I think that's another factor with all kinds of practice, really, which is why a regular practice over a long period of time is important, because it begins to make that new state the status quo, instead of that slight discomfort or, you know, the falling back into old patterns. My favorite example of how this works is here at the Institute, we have a month-long program where people can come for not necessarily because they are great yoga practitioners, but they might come because they need to a break and they just want to be somewhere in a controlled environment for a month or two, or they need to get their health under control, whatever it is. So they come, and we have a very simple and healthy diet compared to what most of us eat in the world, including myself, once I'm not at the Institute. You know, it just the sitting down and cooking the really balanced, perfect meals three times a day, that doesn't happen in any real life scheme that I'm aware of. But here at the Institute, because we're a community, that does happen. And there's a regularity to life and a simplicity to it. And people start feeling very clear and very energetic after about 3 or 4 days. They feel great. They love the food. Everything is wonderful. And then all of a sudden, the irresistible urge to go to town, grab the potato chips.
Oh, I remember that when I did the fries.
Yeah, the Cokes, the chocolate, the whatever. I found myself eating the horrible things that I would never have eaten when I was living on my own because I would have had a slow influx of things that were good in my regular diet, you know, that were yeah, that kept me from being as clear.
Organic sea salt chocolate bar, maybe once a week, so you don't have to grab 90 Hershey's Kisses.
Exactly. That's exactly what happens. And it's a really trying to return to that icky state that's familiar. Mm-hmm. So as soon as you've trashed your body out, you feel normal again, and that's kind of reassuring. And I think the pranayama works on that level as well. Mm-hmm. So you don't feel normal. And even though it feels better, you go back. It's just an odd kind of thing.
Yeah. You know, I don't know if this is particularly helpful for the person who asked that question, but I'm going to share it anyway in case it is. This is something actually that I learned from Sandy that made me practice pranayama. I actually have a really, really hard time meditating. Guessing I'm not the only one who does, but sitting and meditating has always been the thing that I resisted. And Sandy, I remember you taught me to do pranayama before meditation, to do some anuloma and some bhastrika. And I found that when I did that, it was so much easier to meditate. And now the thought of sitting to meditate without doing the pranayama first, like it, I just feel scattered and I can't do it. So to have that, I guess, kind of set schedule or set order of things where I know if I do this, it leads into meditation has helped a lot. Whereas if I tried to do pranayama separately, like say I said, I'm going to do pranayama before I eat my lunch every day, that just wouldn't happen for me. So maybe to associate that pranayama with something else and to see how it really helps you in a practical way might make you more likely to do the pranayama, I would say.
Yeah, I think that's true. And that's exactly why I do the pranayama, is that my meditation practice is orders of magnitude better. And I'm not even willing to sit down and try it. Right. I'm not my pranayama now. The other thing is that you might look at, for the person who's asking the question, look at what your pranayama practice is. Because there are many options. And it could be that you're choosing one that doesn't really give you very much satisfaction and that you might want to adjust what it is you're actually doing.
That's true. I used to think that I had to practice Nadi Shodhanam like every day. And that's a great pranayama practice for a lot of people. But I just really struggled with it and would get super bored. And so when I gave myself permission to not practice Nadi Shodhanam and to practice other pranayamas instead, it became much more enjoyable.
Yeah, I think that's good advice, too. Yeah, always go for the greatest reward.
Interesting advice.
Yes.
Yeah, I found, like Kat, tying it into something, so tying it into meditation or even for me tying it into my asana practice helped a lot. So, like, after I would go through, like, a certain section of my asana practice, I would know that it was time to do Kapalabhati and some of the more vigorous pranayamas or just one or two. And that way it was built into something else.
Yes.
So it wasn't like a set-aside time for anything.
Yeah, and that's good advice for anything you're trying to add to your practice or your schedule or your day or your habits. You hook it on to something you're already doing, and then it just becomes one thing that you're doing instead of another thing you've added. Mm-hmm. And that really helps, too.
Definitely. Our next question that comes from one of our listeners is a question that I've heard about exercise before, but never asana. It says, many students want to know how often they should practice and also feel pressed for time. Is it more beneficial to practice asana a shorter amount of time more often or a longer amount once in a while?
Yes. yes to both. I think the thing that works for most of us is to do a shorter amount regularly, and then every now and then do a long amount. So you sustain a certain practice on a daily basis, which is really important because otherwise you slide back and then you spend time getting back up and then you slide back again. You don't maintain a certain level of balance, shall we say. But then it's good when you have the time or the inclination or the interest, or there's a special class or workshop or some opportunity, and maybe that's a regular thing too. Maybe you take a class once a week, but you have a daily practice that's much shorter. And we all, I know, have fallen into the trap of doing nothing because I don't have time to do everything. Mm-hmm. And that's really one of the worst traps, one of the most common and the most unnecessary traps to fall into. So I think definitely do what an amount that works for you on a regular basis. And then whenever you can, you spend a little more time on a longer practice, exploring some things, getting a little deeper.
Yeah. Good advice.
Yeah, I know that I've had times where I would just not do anything because I didn't have enough time to do all of the things that I wanted to do. But then I realized when I started fitting it in smaller chunks that actually what I wanted to do could be usually fit into a smaller chunk. Yes. I didn't need an elaborate, warm-up or anything like that.
Mm-hmm. You don't always have to do 5 Sun Salute A's and 5 Sun Salute B's before you can do anything else.
Yeah. Exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly. And then you also realize that you have a little bit more time usually than you think you do. Mm-hmm. Or you can make more time. So if I wake up 10 minutes earlier, then I have an extra 10 minutes to practice. Mm-hmm. But it just takes the getting out there.
It does. I watch myself spending 20 minutes trying to convince myself I should do it. Whereas if I wasn't having the argument, it would just happen. And that's kind of the value of having a routine that you just stick to and you don't question. Mm-hmm. It's like brushing your teeth. You don't really argue with yourself about doing that. You just do it. And there's a way in which if you get an amount of practice that doesn't stress everything else in your life, then you just do it. And then, as you say, you can get a lot more done in a short period of time than you would have thought. Mm-hmm. And when you're not always trying to decide what to do or when or how.
That decision fatigue decision, starts to set in.
Yeah.
You make so many decisions about what your daily routine's going to look like, what your diet's going to look like.
And
unless you have those things set already, then you have so much more space to think about other things.
Yes, and you actually get a lot more done because you're not sitting there in your chair trying to figure out what to do.
So this next question actually comes from one of our Yoga International editors, and it's a question about Sanskrit.
Hooray.
And it's not for me, but I think it's a good question. This is a question around the common but incorrect translation of Utkatasana as chair pose. The asker says, I'm definitely a culprit, along with most yoga teachers, particularly vinyasa teachers. In a flow, if I don't translate Utkatasana as chair and Uttanasana as forward bend, then 90% of the class either looks around completely confused or comes into either Utkatasana or Tarasana, regardless of what pose I've called out. Is this bastardization of Sanskrit ruining the language or a necessary and acceptable evolution? How can we get Utkatasana to be called powerful pose instead of chair?
Well, there's a couple things here. I think, one, I almost never use the Sanskrit names in when I'm teaching, partly because of that aforementioned overtraining that we talked about.
Yeah.
And I think sometimes when you just call out the pose, everyone goes into automatic pilot and they're not paying attention. They're just dropping into whatever they did. When I trained horses when I was growing up, and if you overtrain a barrel racing horse, they lose their edge. They start anticipating what's going to come. And they're not, that it's worse than being undertrained in that way. So, if you have the option of actually telling people what you want them to do instead of announcing the posture, and you can do that in a succinct way, then in 2 sentences, you can give the essence of what needs to happen in Utkatasana without announcing either chair pose or Utkatasana or whatever else. I know sometimes in the vinyasa style, there's not a lot of time to do that. And sometimes I find myself also needing to use the name just to give a lot of information in a short period of time so we can get to what it is we really want to get to instead of all the instruction it takes to set it up and get into it. So in that case, I think it's fine to use the English translation or whatever English word resonates with your folks, because your intention is not for them to know the names of things. It's to have the experience. So if that's your intention, is to actually guide them towards a particular experience, then you use a name in service of that. I myself will use the Sanskrit names when I think most people know what they are, like Shavasana or Trikonasana, because they're common. Mm-hmm. And I also use the, but I'll use the English name if the Sanskrit name is very long and awkward, like Downward Facing Dog. Why not just say Downward Facing Dog?
Right.
The only the other thing to add to this conversation might be that often an in-depth look at the Sanskrit name will give you some clue to the hidden essence of what the posture is about. And in that case, it's good to bring it forward, but it takes a little time to describe that. So if you have the luxury of explaining what the name means in some way, that's helpful to giving that experience that you're wanting to, then definitely you use the name, and then you can either explain what it is, or if you've done that with people that you see regularly, then that brings forward that body of information that's attached to the name. So Utkatasana, and then here's another part of this conversation also, is that the literal translation that we sometimes attach to the Sanskrit name is not necessarily very helpful, nor is it necessarily mine the deeper levels of meaning that might be available if we were more versed in the esoteric aspects of yoga practice or in the great variety of meanings most words have in Sanskrit. I read a joke just the other day about Sanskrit that every well-pedigreed Sanskrit word has at least four meanings. It means the meaning you think, it has the opposite meaning. It's the name of a deity or has some attribute of a deity, and it's the name of some sexual posture. Now, I don't know about that fourth one because that isn't something I'm well-versed in terms of what the names are, but a lot of the names have, or words in Sanskrit have, so many meanings that to say that Utkatasana, for example, means powerful or fierce or whatever, is not necessarily the most useful way of thinking about that particular name. And if you look at the breaking it down, for example, Ut is actually Ud, and it means upward. It's a prefix that gives a sense of upward moving or upward. It has that sense of it. And kata is a word that is cutting, harvesting is one of the ways I've heard it described. So another way of looking at Utkatasana is the harvesting of this upward moving energy in the body, which, of course, is Udana.
Right.
That's a useful concept in that pose. So in that sense, it might be useful if you are actually in the pose long enough to give people time to begin to experience that, to have that concept in their mind may be very helpful to their inner experience of the pose. Otherwise, I don't think it makes the slightest bit of difference whether you call it chair pose or whatever powerful pose. None of those are particularly useful other than letting students know what it is they need to move to, where they need to move next. And in that case, it doesn't really make that much difference.
That's encouraging. I know I've found the longer I teach, the less Sanskrit I use in asana class, just because it simply is usually more practical and more useful to just describe the actual movement that you want somebody to do. But every now and then, if students seem really interested and I get excited about a fun fact, like what you just said about Utkatasana and upward cutting, like my brain just went, "Ooh, that's so cool."
Yeah.
So that's the sort of thing that maybe somebody else might find that useful or cool. And if you're really exploring the more more energetic aspects of the pose, it would actually be quite useful as well.
Yeah. And there's a right time and context for that kind of a description.
Yeah. Maybe not your power vinyasa flow at the YMCA, but definitely.
Yeah. Or maybe your preparation for that when you're breaking down something like the sun salutation, then there's time to explain those things. But The other time that I tend to use the Sanskrit names if I need to is when there isn't an easy English translation.
Oh, like Ekapadagalavasana or the sage poses.
Yes, or Kapotasana or, well, that's not so bad, I guess. I'm thinking of Paschimottanasana.
Oh, sure.
Where seated forward bend has so many different variations or so many possibilities that... Does anyone know the Paschimottanasana? You know, what? How would you, it takes a lot of English words to describe what that pose is, so I tend to use that, even though it's not a very easy word for people.
But it's so prevalent in yoga classes now, I think, that many people just know it.
I think a lot of the classic asanas, most people who've been in for a while have learned, and they've learned just because some teacher has said, triangle pose, Trikonasana, or Trikonasana, the triangle pose, until finally you make that association. Mm-hmm. And I think Paschimottanasana is one where we tend to use that because it's not very specific to say seated forward bend. That could be Padakonasana, it could be Uddavishakonasana, it could be Marichyasana, it could be Janushirshasana. There's a whole bunch of things it could be. So it's easier to associate the Sanskrit with the word and just kind of teach your students that that's what it is.
I know that as a student myself, I sometimes like to hear the Sanskrit repeated in class because otherwise it just falls out of my memory if I don't hear it enough. So when I teach, I'll like challenge myself to bring it up and like say the English and the Sanskrit too. So I do like it when teachers.
It adds, it does add the dimension if you use, when you're using both, making a connection to the lineage and the tradition.
Right,
so you know, you're not just in an exercise class, but you're remembering you're in this bigger body of knowledge, and that's a nice thing too.
Mm-hmm. Colin Hall, who's written for Yoga International, he has an article on his blog that appeared a couple years ago about like the case for using Sanskrit in class, and I'll link to that in the show notes too because I found that quite interesting. Talked very much about that, about honoring where these poses actually come from and honoring their history and their context. I think that article used the example of butterfly versus Baddha-Konasana and even translating Baddha-Konasana as butterfly instead of bound angle and the cost and benefits of that. highly recommend it.
Our next question is more anatomical. It says, what role does skeletal structure play in accessing the full expression of an asana? And is there a way to assess if my joints rather than my muscles are affecting my postures? If it's skeletal structure that's a limiting factor, can anything be done about it?
I think that probably skeletal proportions and things like ligament strength and et cetera have more of an influence than maybe we previously recognized 25 years ago or 30 years ago, especially when I first started some 35 or 40 years ago. So not everyone is going to be able to look like Mr. Iyengar because they don't have the long arms and the short torso and the long legs. You know, it just isn't going to work out.
Oh, I identify with not having those things very strongly.
Yeah, me too. After 30 years, I think, well, wait a minute. And also as a teacher, after 25 years of teaching Shalabhasana, the locust pose, realizing, you know, that women who actually are well endowed in the chest region, it's a terrible pose for them. And here I've been telling them all these years, you know, just get your arms under there and press down. And it's like their sternum isn't anywhere near the floor. So, I think it makes a big difference. And especially in the joints, you know, your experience in the pose should not be in the joints. And if it is, then there's something wrong with the way the pose is being executed, or you push too far, or there needs to be a reckoning on your part to accommodate the asana in your body in a way that gives you the experience of the asana, not punishing the joints or punishing any other part of the body for that matter. So, and the range of flexibility is, you know, there are so many factors involved in flexibility and strength both, that honoring the limitations does not mean that you are not addressing the things that need to be addressed. But it does take some practice and discrimination on your part to figure out, am I just being lazy here? Or do I need to adjust in some way? I think, again, kind of framing your practice as to what you intend to do and making that not about creating more external capacity but more about an inner experience will often be a guide that helps you to move more deeply in the right direction without traumatizing your skeletal alignment.
Yeah. And Kat, you might be able to speak to this too, but I feel like that also helps kind of to unlock the postures.
Yes.
Because when you're focusing so much on the external, then it becomes all about that. But when you focus on the internal, then you make progress towards it without so much attachment. It's almost like if you're not so focused, then you come back to it in like 3 months and all of a sudden you can do the posture perfectly, whereas you've just been doing like preps or modifications.
Well, the nervous system is a really big component in your capacity, and you don't get very far by bullying your nervous system. So that's one reason, practical reason to change how you're working.
Yeah, that was very true in my case with certain poses that I just thought like, oh, I can never do these poses. When I stopped trying to do them and just did a variation that worked with my capacity, whether it was using a prop or doing a different variation, I found that if I worked with that regularly, instead of just avoiding the pose because I disliked it, then I made progress and in some cases eventually moved toward the pose that I thought that I could never do. But I also kind of realized that that wasn't as much the point through that process,
yes,
too.
Yes, that's right.
Yeah, and I think that's what Emily was speaking to as well.
Also, I think, and again, this comes only from experience, but often the way we have learned things is not necessarily the best way to do them. And I see this a lot in students that have been trained. And, you know, in the beginning, you don't know, so you follow what is presented. But after a while, you start to understand what the intention is or what your intention is in working with a pose. And then you need to question some of the things that are the way you come into Trikonasana or some of the standing poses, for example. I have stopped teaching them the way I learned them because I'm understanding now that the intention behind that is sometimes distorted by the emphasis on stretching the arms out as you fold forward. Yeah. It pulls people's minds out of the core of the body as opposed to having them be more grounded and moving from a deeper place in the body. So when you realize the standing poses aren't so much about how the arms are placed until the final finishing part, then your emphasis in performing or in doing the asana shifts and you feel free to kind of make the instruction in a way that for yourself or in your teaching that gets more to what you would like to have the experience be as opposed to the rigid way in which we might have been trained or the way the picture book looks. So your seated twist, your hand may not be flat on the floor because you have a long spine and short arms. So, you know, you don't want to make your body look like somebody else's. You want to remember what the intention is, what you're trying, experience you're trying to have. And again, that does take some experience.
Yeah. And Sandy, you teach a really nice class with a focus on the intention of each posture. So as the producer, I'm just going to plug our Yoga International classes and say if you want to take a class with Sandy, you should definitely check them out on yogainternational.com. And really like explore the energetics of the posture and come back to the core. Cause so often we start doing these fancy things with our arms and thinking about ourselves or looking at ourselves in mirrors as we practice and
And it's not that the arms aren't important. It's just that they need to be an expression of a deeper connection. Mm-hmm. And that's what sometimes gets lost in a rigid way of performing the asana or teaching it. So you start questioning is this, how can I feel better in this pose, or what's going to be more rewarding for me? And then it might be that you do need a block, and it might not be because you're a bad student. It's because your body is different.
Oh, yeah. I mean, I've told this story a bunch of times on the podcast, but I remember a couple different instances where I was sitting in Dandasana when I first started practicing, and I, as I mentioned, have a long body and short arms, and would come up onto my fingertips or put blocks under my hands. And one time a teacher said to me, once you get more flexible, you can bring your hands flat to the floor. And I just was trying to figure out how exactly that would happen. And then another time I had a teacher push my hands flat to the floor so my spine rounded. And both times I was just kind of sitting there like, but to have that, both of those instances brought up the realization that no matter how much yoga I practice, no matter how, quote, flexible I get, no matter how, quote, good I get, my arms aren't going to get longer. They're just not. And that was kind of empowering to see that adapting the pose didn't mean that I was a bad yogi or a remedial yogi or inferior in any way. It just meant I was born with short arms. And
yeah. And it also meant you understood that the point behind that pose was not putting your hands flat on the floor. It was the hands pressing down are meant to lift the spine. And so if you have to bend the spine to put your hands on the floor, you've defeated the whole purpose of the pose. And that's exactly what we need to understand about the asanas. And that's kind of a gut level realization as well as a discriminating faculty and experience. But yeah, that's exactly the point.
So I think coming back to the question, just to wrap it up, it says if it is a skeletal structure, if it's skeletal structure that's a limiting factor, can anything be done about it? I think the answer is you can use props, but you can't change your skeletal
structure. You can't make your arms grow longer or shorter.
Well, you might get your arms a little longer, but your spine will get longer too.
That's
so relatively things aren't changing in that respect.
Yeah. And is there a way to assess if my joints rather than my muscles are affecting my posture? And that would be if you're feeling the postures in your joint.
I think so. Kat, do you have any advice there about how to be aware of a joint thing going on as opposed to muscle?
One thing that I've heard, and this was, I think Down Dog was a pretty good example. I believe this was from Paul Grilley, if I'm not mistaken. He said that, like, for example, if you're in downward facing dog and your heels aren't touching the floor, which is common for, I would probably say, most practitioners, that if you feel the resistance coming from the back of your calves or the back of your legs, then that's an indicator that it's muscle tightness that's restricting you. Whereas if you feel the restriction in the front, like in the front of your shins, and you feel like that bone on bone grinding in the ankles and the foot, then that's an indicator that it's your bone structure that's restricting you. And probably, you know, and this is me talking as opposed to Paul Grilley at this point, but probably that's something that you can't really do that much about. Whereas the muscle tightness is something that you could address with further stretching.
Yes, and if you modified the pose in some way, you might move the experience to the muscle rather than the bone, and eventually find that the bone experience or the joint restriction that you're experiencing may lessen if you're able to work with the muscle. Always. You know, I look at people in Baddha Konasana, for example. This is another classic one where the difference in the hip structure, hip joint, is so variable from individuals that the fact that your knees are or are not down on the floor is sometimes muscle, but sometimes it's the way the ligaments or the way the femur fits into the pelvis. And if you feel it in your joints or you feel a bone on the bone in the hip, then definitely that's something not to be, you know, to back away from.
Yeah, you don't want to push further into that.
Yeah, exactly.
So we have time for one more question, I think. And this is one Emily and I were both discussing our curiosity about. So I'm excited to ask you this one. And this question comes from one of our Yoga International editors. The question is, are different emotions stored in different areas of the body? If so, where? I've heard more than once that hips hold sadness and hamstrings hold fear. Just wondering if this is a commonly understood thing, and if so, whether there are other parallels.
You know, there's maybe a loose correlation. I don't know that there's really a one-on-one kind of thing, and you can point to anger as being any place. When I'm mad, it's everywhere. Also, I think that because of our history and injuries or use or misuse or, you know, whatever, our inheritance, we have built-in weaknesses, particular areas, and those are the things that might break down regardless of what the particular emotional response is. You know, any emotional response tends to elevate a certain activation in the body with the nervous system and hormones and so on. But the organ that gives out over a long term of that kind of thing may be the one that is already weak or injured or damaged or whatever, as opposed to particular organ. So I'm not sure there's a specific universal correlation between any particular emotions. There's an overall level of tension that tends to creep in, and those tension patterns are habitual and not necessarily related to the emotion. They're just related to being disturbed in one way or another. So when I'm disturbed, I clench my jaw and my left hip. It doesn't matter if it's excitement or anger or fear. It's the same response. Mm-hmm. So yeah. You could say, yeah, fear goes here, but also any other strong thing goes there too. So,
That's really, really, I'm so glad you said that. And I also think that as yoga teachers, pretty much most of the time, it's not really helpful for us to tell students, oh, your hamstrings are tight, that means you're afraid. Oh, your hips are tight, that means that you're angry. Like, that just is kind of imposing things upon people. I'll never forget, I was telling Emily this story earlier too, that I was in a workshop once and a student raised her hand in the workshop and said to the teacher, so I have a hard time with back bends and my chest is really tight. And another teacher told me that that meant that my heart is closed off. Is that true? And this teacher leading the workshop said, it's really irresponsible and not okay for a yoga teacher to tell you your heart is closed off. I can't tell you whether that's true or not, but probably, you know, you work at a desk. A lot of us do. A lot of us drive a lot. What I can tell you is there's tension in your chest, and these are the poses you can do, and that there's not necessarily any correlation with how closed off your heart is. And this person was so relieved, so happy. Like, really? I'm not closed off? Really? And just to get that relief was amazing. And that really showed me, you know, like what you know, powerful responsibility we have as yoga teachers, because students believe what we say.
We do. And that's an area that, you know, it's the reason people believe you when you say things like that is that they don't have any evidence to contradict what the yoga teacher is saying. You know, you're in this mystical territory somehow as the yoga teacher. And so people are looking for you to explain things that they can't understand in any other way. And for that reason, we need to be very careful about saying things that are just not necessarily true or simplistic in some way. Mm-hmm. And that is more the case with this correlation between emotion and things in the body. It's much more complicated, I think, energetically and emotionally than the simplistic answer would allow us to have. And even if we did know, as you pointed out rightfully, Kat, saying that to somebody, especially in a public forum like a class, is really not okay.
It seems like almost taking the reverse attitude would be more helpful. So when you like approach the body, there are different things going on energetically when the body is well aligned. Mm-hmm. And so moving from that space, thinking about like opening up so that you can experience that rather than thinking of yourself as like closed off already, just thinking that there's always like more opportunity to be more well aligned.
Right. There's better alignment. There's a better energetic integration is the word I like to use that you're looking for. And that may bring some kind of emotion to the forefront. I mean, we've all had that happen.
Oh, yeah.
And you may associate it with having worked more deeply in the body, but it's not necessarily lodged in a particular thing, perhaps, but rather your mind has sunk more deeply into the into the depths and yeah. and has discovered your hidden anger.
Well, you're feeling something too. Like yes. a really common one is a lot of people say they cry in pigeon pose sometimes. And I've had that happen. Like, you know, I wasn't sad as far as I was aware, but I was in pigeon and I started to cry. And I kind of thought of it like I'm feeling something. I'm feeling this intense stretch in my hips and somehow I'm feeling emotional things too. And I don't know that analyzing that to death is necessarily the best idea, but just to kind of also acknowledge that it's a common experience can make people feel like, oh, well, I'm not so weird because I cried in pigeon, because lots of people do that too.
Yeah, it's a very deep anchoring of the mind and the tension, the deep tension that is that we've been protecting ourselves with somehow gets, we get in touch with that. And yeah. that might have an emotion associated with it. Might even have a memory associated, not necessarily, yeah. but sometimes. So, you know, the body does kind of store things, but I'm not, you know, it can be from a number of different places that those kind of buried tension patterns start to arise. So,
great. Thank you, Sandy, so much for answering these questions that we had and that our listeners had. We'll have to have you back soon.
I'd be happy to. Yes, it's always fun to talk about these wonderful things that we experience in yoga practice.
And if you have any questions for Sandy or for Emily and I, or just about yoga in general or about the podcast, you can email those to yogatalk@yogainternational.com. And we would love to hear your show ideas as well. If you want more from Sandy, as Emily mentioned, you can find lots of her classes on yogainternational.com, as well as some excellent articles she's written and some e-courses that you can take with her as well, like on Sanskrit and on the psoas. And Emily, you guys just did an audio series, didn't you?
Yeah, we just did an audio series exploring the depths of yoga practice. So we'll release that soon. But another video class that we're pretty excited about is exploring the classical asanas.
Oh, yeah.
So some of the asanas that we usually forget about or leave out of our practice, Sandy teaches us how to start to integrate into those.
Yeah, the classic asanas are so much fun, and yeah. sometimes we forget because we make so many modifications.
Yeah, I'm excited about that practice for sure. We are going to take you out today with our dear friends, the Householders, and Namaste Nation one more time. Bye, everybody.